You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
There is a story we've heard too many times. A pioneer builds the fortune, their children enjoy it, and by the third generation, it's gone. But why? Tonight, we're not interested in echoing warnings. We're here to rewrite the narrative with strategies, not superstition. Because while trauma may explain the past, it doesn't have to write the future. To help us explore how to build wealth that outlives us, we're joined by a woman who's doing the work with clarity, compassion, and undeniable results. Vanyile Magwagwa is the founder of Wealthy Money, again, no stranger to the show. And she's a financial healer, author, teacher, and powerhouse behind a movement helping people become deliberate stewards of abundance. But don't let healer fool you. Her approach is rooted in structure and strategy and systems that empower everyday people to build wealth that sticks. Tonight, we dig into the question behind the myth. Can wealth really last beyond three generations? And what must we do practically to make sure that it does? Vanyile, again, welcome to the show, ma'am.
Thank you, Mpumi.
How do you do?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm doing well, too. Now, let's hop right into it, right? What is the first thing a person should do the moment they start earning a steady income if they want to build generational wealth? And I'm starting here because when we think wealth, we often think, I need to make a certain amount of money so that I can start doing this, that, and the other. I wanted to take it back to the grassroots. The moment somebody starts earning a steady income, what is the first thing they should focus on doing?
I think once you start earning a steady stream of income, you have to start focusing on how are you going to start creating an extra stream of income without working? So how do you create passive income?
So I'm earning this money and I must still think about another way to earn more money.
Yeah, how do you make this money that you're earning work for you?
Got it.
You know, and for most people, one of the easiest ways is to get property and then on that property, do what our parents did, right? Which our grandparents, which is build back roofs. And now you've got that money that's making an extra stream of income for you.
Yeah. Apart from that, we are often told or taught to buy assets, but I need us to break it down, right? You've just mentioned property. What are two other real assets someone in their 20s, their 30s, or even their 40s? And I also want to say 50s because it's never too late. What real assets should they seriously be considering?
Well, I think for real assets that people should be considering, you can buy property, but outside of property, exchange traded funds, right? ETFs. So you're investing in indices, and then you can also invest in shares. I mean, there's other people that are entrepreneurial, so starting a business, but it is highly risky. Most businesses fail. Like, what is it? 20% of all startups fail within the first year, or 50% fail within the first year. And then the remaining, or the first 2 years, sorry. And then the remaining 40, and then another 45% fail within 10 years. I was reading that this weekend. So one of the easiest ways is to really buy shares. And also buy exchange traded funds. You can also invest in government bonds if you're not very big on risk. So, and of course, people can always, but if you're starting out, it's not practical to invest in things like art, right? Which most people talk about. And I know people also invest in jewelry, like pure gold jewelry. So like having your money stored in gold. It's not practical. You want something that will give you Not just a return on investment, not just increase in value, but also give you some kind of cash flow later on.
You know, as you're talking, I'm realizing the plethora of ways that we can invest. And some of us barely know those things, right? I remember listening to one of my coaches a couple of years ago, and she was buying luxury bags. And I'm like, this lady, these are so expensive. And she was saying, I know what you're thinking. I know what you guys are thinking about. Why would you buy such an expensive bag? And she says, because it retains value. At some point, this very bag will be vintage at some point, and I would have it would have been something that I invested in. But before we move from these real assets, I really do want you to explain the difference between ETFs, exchange traded funds, as well as shares. What are the difference between those two? And then we'll talk about business a bit, because I do think there's a way that is less risky for people to start businesses, but we can talk about it after we have compared and contrasted the two, ETFs and shares.
Okay, so ETFs are basically just indices. That just means that, like, instead of investing in one share, someone went and decided, okay, in this country or even on a global level, these are all the companies that are maybe dividend paying companies. We will lump them up together so that an investor doesn't have to choose one particular company. And what that does is that you are now diversified across maybe industries, especially if it's dividend paying shares. Note that you can also have ETFs based on an industry, like, for example, the construction industry or industrials, as Satrix has. So what you're doing is you're trying to diversify the risk for the investor. And you're saying we're investing in the entire market of a particular group of shares. So it will be investing in about 40 companies all at once, and you're investing a fraction in each company. Yeah. So when you invest in shares, you're becoming a shareholder usually in one company. So ETFs are shares of multiple companies, right? And then when you're investing in shares, you're investing in the share of one company. Yeah. So why most people will sometimes choose to invest in shares of one company is, say, if you want to have a say in the company, you look at a company like maybe Facebook and you go, well, I have a lot of money and I would rather be a majority shareholder so that I can have a say in how the company is run and I can then, like, control the voting rights of that company. So that's if you have a lot of money, right? And then you can, like, start to play around with investing in individual shares. But even people that have a lot of money do invest in ETFs a lot. The reason for that is because most ETFs and most indices around the world, like, you've probably heard of the S&P 500, you've heard of the Satrix 40, all of those, they tend to do better over time. Always, throughout history, they've always done better than choosing individual shares. So usually investors will try to beat the market, quote unquote, by choosing one share or several shares and then trading those shares. But if you just invest in an ETF and you chill, over time, that ETF will usually do better than, say, an individual share that you choose as an investor. So you'll often hear the term that nobody beats the market, except if you're Warren Buffett or Peter Lynch, right?
And let's talk about business, because when you spoke about investing in a business, you mentioned how highly risky it is. And I don't want that to dissuade anyone from starting, but I do want to say, I believe that the best way to start is possibly a service-based business, because it requires less capital upfront or startup capital, and it's already something that you know or can do. So you've already got the skill, you've already got the acumen. Something about somebody who is already in an HR role at work, right? And people know this already, and they're asking them things on the side. They could very well capitalize on those requests on the side and build something of a business with what they already know. So I think the best way to go about starting something of your own is focusing on a skill you already have that can help you structure or organize a service-based business because of the lesser capital requirements upfront and also your ability to charge higher, so that if you do want to diversify into products or into selling something physical, then you've already got capital that you've generated from the service-based business that will allow you to then invest in either another business or even in these ETFs and shares and all of those things. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think if you had to start a business, then a service-based business is the best one, right? But it also doesn't mean that, like, a service-based businesses, product-based businesses, they also highly risky. And I speak as an entrepreneur. Like, all I've done my whole adult life is be an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah.
But I'm also realizing that there are easier ways to get to to get to our wealth goals, and entrepreneurship is not the only way to get there, right? So I don't want to toot it as the only way, right?
No, it's not. And so, it's a very difficult way also.
Right? Yeah. So service-based businesses are definitely the best because they require less capital upfront. And you can just literally start, let's say that you in a media or something, you can start a side business and be a consultant, take on clients, and whatever profits you make, you can put right back into investing either in real estate or investing in the stock market or investing in bonds. Yeah.
Yeah. Vangile, why do so many people look rich but aren't actually wealthy? You know, when I go there on Instagram, I look at people's profiles and I'm like, is you really rich? Is you wealthy? Or is you just flashy? What's the trap there? And how do we avoid it? Because we are talking generational wealth.
Okay. So I think one of the easiest things in our generation is to look rich without being rich, right? So rich or wealth is having assets. Is having an asset that you can create an income from. So when everything goes haywire, even if you lose your job, you're able to maintain your lifestyle, right? So what happens in our day and age is that as soon as most people graduate, especially our doctors, lawyers, engineers, the first thing that happens is the banks are on you and offering you credit.
Sure.
So you have access to so much credit. And most people don't know what is good credit and what's bad credit, because buying a house, it's unfortunate that we live in a world where it's easier to buy a car than it is to buy a house. The process is much more rigorous to get a house. And cars are like 5 year within, they'll give you a 5 year term, even if some cars are now way more expensive than houses. So the system has actually made it so much easier to access debt for things that are not real assets and won't create an extra stream of income for you. But for example, after 5 years, a car has lost its value. Someone actually said, as soon as you drive your BMW off the lot, it's already started depreciating. But most properties, if you think about it, if you bought a property in Mpumalanga or Cape Town, chances are in 5 years, it's increased in value by at least 50 or 60%. And that value, and you can actually access that cash by refinancing your property and using that very same cash to maybe max out your tax-free savings and then like put more money into your retirement annuity or put more money into ETFs and then create an extra stream of income from dividend paying shares. So it's unfortunate that the system is such that you can access a personal loan and a car loan so much easier than you can access a home loan.
Yeah.
And the requirements are less stringent, so it becomes easy to look rich without actually having assets.
I'm thinking about all the financial mistakes I've made in the past. And you know, while I'm thinking and condemning myself, I'm just like, Bumi, it's not too late. You're still in your 30s, girl. It's okay. You'll be fine. What is one money habit you've seen wealthy families master that keeps the wealth in the bloodline?
Well, one of the biggest money habits, more than saving, investing, all of that, is talking about money and giving and having financial education and financial literacy. Nothing beats that, because I think how many of us have seen it, right? We see it all the time in South Africa, and you see it even internationally, where like parents work so hard and then parents pass on and then they leave the money to the next generation.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a heartbreaking I Blew It episode on this, where two brothers were left a huge amount of money from their mom and when she passed on. And they blew all that money and ended up selling the family home as well. Right? Because there has been no financial education.
Yeah.
But not only beyond financial education, one of the things that the wealthy do is they also set up systems so that if there is someone in the family who is more prone to gambling or squandering the family wealth, there are systems in place to make sure that that wealth survives. But actually, history shows that that's not enough. Having trust funds, and that's a new thing with us as Black families. We're like, oh no, I'll just have it in a trust fund. What a trust fund does is it just simply delays the entire process, right, for a few more generations. But if you want wealth to last 200 years, 300 years, like I was reading something ridiculous in Japan, the one of the oldest businesses is in Japan, and it's gone from family, from one generation to the next in the family, and has continued to grow for 1,000 years. That has come from educating each generation on how to run the business, on the wealth, all of that. And right now, like I was also I was watching a podcast that was sharing that, like, in Japan there are now bankers that are looking at how do you that do planning within a family, sit down and do financial planning with the family for the next 300 years. We are in South Africa and we're talking about, oh, my retirement annuity for our lifetime. In other countries, people are thinking about 300 years. That is three centuries.
Yes.
Right? And that mean, and what they're also putting into place is how do you educate the next generation for the next three centuries so that they continue with the mission. So that is one of the biggest things. And we don't talk about money. We don't sit down at the dinner table and talk about how do you create wealth, mainly because we ourselves don't have that knowledge.
Oh, for sure.
So that means that we have to go looking for that knowledge so we can pass it down. It goes beyond, this is how you save, this is how you manage debt. We're talking about, how do you create wealth? What do you do with your with the equity in your house? We're so obsessed with just like, let's pay off the equity in our house, right? But what do you actually do with this one asset so that it actually then breeds more and makes more money for you? We don't sit down and talk. We don't have advisors. We don't have financial advisors. People don't sit down and do estate planning. They don't have like an entire team that sits with them. I remember last year when my financial advisor said, we're going to set up a board of directors just for you to just give you advice. Like, why would I do that?
What do you mean?
Yeah. But, but like just sitting down and talking to those people is really, really important. And I realize that that's actually something that the wealthy have access to. They sit down and they say, what is your problem for this month? And how do you maneuver this?
Sure.
We don't have that, and we
We
don't sit down and talk
don't.
about it amongst each other
No, we
as family
don't.
members, even if we have very little. The
Yeah.
important is to start having, the important thing is to start having those these conversations.
Sure. And while we're on here, I mean, we're talking structures, right? Things like trusts and wills and businesses. What legal or financial vehicles should ordinary black professionals be learning about right now? And I don't even want to ask why, because it's important, right? We are
Yeah.
getting poorer by the generation, whereas our counterparts are getting wealthier by the generation. So what are these legal and financial vehicles that we should be learning about now?
So I think the first thing, when I talk about financial education, one of the things that the wealthy are doing is learning how to also regulate their nervous systems around money. It's
Oh.
not a financial vehicle, but it is a huge thing.
Hi.
Teaching people how to sit and be able to talk about money. That's nervous system regulation. They invest heavily in their personal development, in learning how to manage their nervous systems, learning how to talk about money. So communication is a skill,
Can you,
right?
before
So
Vangile,
that's
you've
one of the
touched,
things. It's a soft skill.
yeah, Vangile,
But
you've
one,
struck a nerve with me, right? You've struck a chord with
yeah.
me because I think I'm one of the people who need that regulation, right? My nervous system regulation around money, because I'm a very confident girl. Listen, I will talk your ear down on anything. When we start
Yeah.
talking money, I'm just like, suddenly I have a stutter.
Right?
Suddenly I'm fidgety. Suddenly I'm talking in codes. And it's just like, girl, what is going on? So before you even move, because I heard you say this is the foundation, before we even talk vehicles and stuff like that, this is where we start. So if you can, in a very short amount of time, how does one even begin regulating their nervous system, firstly around having conversations with money, about money rather, and then also navigating their way around the money. Because I think a lot of the decisions we also make are from a place of just a dysregulated nervous system. So I'm your case study. Please, Sisi, I need your life. I need your help.
It's so funny because someone messaged me today and they were like, oh, you talked about having conversations around money and relationships. And he was talking
Yeah.
about he's a gentleman that has had me come and talk at some of his events. And he was saying to me that, like, when he talks about money, he had an argument over just talking about the Pope and money. And
Yo.
he's like, how was that a triggering conversation in my relationship? I was like, the conversation mentioned money.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that it included the Pope.
Oh,
You
I'm that
know,
person. I will
who
scratch
cares?
my
We're talking
foot.
about
You're
money
talking about
in
money.
context of the Pope. Money was mentioned, right? So the first thing is to really work with yourself before you can even talk about money in a relationship. I always say to people come to me and they're like screaming and they're like, oh, my husband doesn't know how to talk about money. My wife doesn't know how to talk about money. And it's like, how do you feel about talking about money? Because when they are dysregulated, they will, and you haven't learned how to regulate yourself, you then become dysregulated. And then you have two adults who are dysregulated talking about money. And it's not the adults that are reacting to this conversation. It's both your childhoods, your inner childhood, your inner teen. Then you're actually having 4-year-olds or 16-year-olds
No, talking
talking
about
about money in the
money.
relationship. So the first thing to do is understand your relationship with money and what happens in your nervous system whenever you manage money or money is mentioned. You need to become clear on what's happening with your breath. Whenever money is mentioned or whenever you talk about money or you deal with money, observe your breath. So one of the easiest ways is looking at your bank account 5 minutes a day, observing your breath for 5 minutes, and then observing the sensations in your body for 5 minutes, and then observing the thoughts that are happening whenever your breath and the sensations in your body are shifting. Write down those thoughts and then start to question those thoughts. Because here's what will happen, even if you're dealing with a dysregulated partner when it comes to money, they will become dysregulated. They may get upset and start shouting. But if you can remain calm and create that space for them to have that emotion, the big emotions, and realize that, wait, their four-year-old self is having a big emotion now.
Yeah,
I need to be the one that holds the fort, even if they are losing it, and remain calm and give them an opportunity to go through that and then come back the next day and say, okay, it's not a triggering situation right now. Tell me what happened yesterday. Yeah. Like, can we talk about it?
Yeah.
Do you see how that you then can also become that safe space for that unraveling and for their story to come up? And eventually they can also do the same for you. But if you're both dysregulated, then nothing can happen. And what often then happens with people, they try to teach their children about money, but you're dysregulated and you're screaming. A child is asking for something, but I told you we should be saving. I told you we should be saving. How can you be asking me for this?
Yeah.
Now you are dysregulated. Your child then gets dysregulated. The entire money conversation goes haywire. Right? But if you can remain regulated, even if your child is going to is dysregulated, or you're regulated and you're suddenly teaching your child that you can have conversations around money from a space of regulation.
Yeah.
Without getting dysregulated, you can sit down and say, okay, tell me what it is that you want. Here's what I would recommend. Let's first, what if we invest this and then we wait another 6 months and then you see your returns on your shares? I have clients that are doing this with like their 13-year-old daughters, 16-year-old daughters, literally teaching them about shares because they've now regulated and saying, okay, now that your dividends have come in, now you can spend from these dividends, you know, but that cannot happen if you are screaming at the child and dysregulating them because you yourself are dysregulated.
Yeah.
You are now teaching your child's nervous system that every time we talk about money or deal with money, it has to be from a space of dysregulation and it's no longer fun.
You know what I was wondering as you were speaking, you mentioned the, and you've said this a number of times, that sits with your bank statements or your bank accounts or the app, whatever it is, for 5 minutes and observe your breath, observe how you feel in the gut. Is it possible that, you know this whole thing of acclimatizing, right? That you, at first, a smell or smoke in the room irritates you. After some time, suddenly you don't even smell it doesn't even smell bad anymore. Is it possible to get so acclimatized to the chaos because you're looking at it so often and it's not changing that it no longer gives you the sensation or the heavy breathing or even a panic attack like it used to in the beginning?
That's a good question, actually.
Yeah.
I think that it's not that you're acclimatizing in the same way that you're thinking of, right? It's that, how do I explain this? Money is money, and your nervous system reaction is your nervous system reaction. Your nervous system learned how to react to the lack of money or money going out or even receiving money, money increasing in your bank account a particular way. So when you are looking at your bank account, you're actually reminding your nervous system that it is safe to get to regulation. Now, regulation will feel like neutrality. Most people want to feel excitement and joy and all the insane things that they are taught from the manifestation teachers when it comes to dealing with money, but that's actually not what you're going for.
So
because what you're then training your nervous system to feel every time is not neutrality. You're training your nervous system to only get excited when money comes in. What does it feel when money doesn't come in? Right? But you want your nervous system to feel neutral at all times so that it is regulated and then you can make decisions from a place that has no charge. That's the whole idea of like making rational decisions, right? So that's where you want to be. It's not that you get used to it.
Yeah.
It's that your nervous system stops reacting the way it was trained to react, and it starts to get to neutral. And that's a very good place to be at. And it will not always react like that. So you will know, because there's another thing that we do when we have intense trauma around something, we dissociate, which means that we numb ourselves.
Yeah.
So you will know that you are numbing yourself when every single day, whatever movements are happening in your bank account, you feel nothing.
You couldn't be bothered.
Right?
Yeah.
You couldn't be bothered. Then you've dissociated, you're numb. You haven't, you're not actually doing nervous system regulation. True nervous system regulation is that I feel anger, I feel hurt, I feel frustrated, I feel anxious, I feel all the emotions, but I'm also able to, after 5 to 10 minutes, get back into balance. I can look at my bank account and be like, freak out, close it, and then observe my breath, observe the sensations in my body, and then come back to center.
Yeah.
Then you're starting to regulate. A truly regulated nervous system is not a nervous system that never feels anger, never feels fear, never feels any of those things. It's a nervous system that feels all of the emotions, but doesn't get stuck in the emotion. It's able to move through emotions. So if you are looking at your bank account and you're doing this exercise and you feel absolutely zero, you are dissociating. You learn to deal with trauma by going into flight mode and pretending it is not happening.
I want us to talk about something else that can really knock your nervous system right. Debt. Being knee deep in debt. Where does someone who is 100K in debt begin turning the ship around while still holding on to this wealth building goal that we're discussing today?
Same concept. This is where I started when I was $60,000 in debt, looking at my bank account every day for 5 minutes a day, then observing my breath for another 5 minutes, then observing the sensations in my body for 5 minutes, and writing down the thoughts that came up for 5 minutes, and then I would spend the whole day throughout the day just constantly questioning some of the thoughts that came up for me. Right? So that's where you start. And then the next step is to list your debt in ascending order. So from the smallest to the largest. This is really quite simple. Most people always say to me, why can't I do it from highest interest rate to lowest interest rate? You can do that too. But for most people, they go from smallest to the largest simply because most people, when you pay off one debt, you feel so excited and
true.
It gives you the motivation to keep going, right?
Yeah.
So when I had like, I don't know, 5 credit cards, being able, some of my credit cards were like $250 and maxed out. So just paying that $250 and then writing it off gave me so much motivation to keep going. So that's why I say try to do ascending order from smallest to the largest. But again, I have clients that go from highest interest rate to lowest interest rate. That's your thing. Go for it.
Sure,
right.
Sure.
And then what you want to do when you do, this is called the snowball effect, right? So you want to start, you want to list every single debt. And then as you pay off the debt, the next debt that you pay off, then once you pay off the first debt, all the money that you were using to pay off that first debt and servicing it every single month, put it towards the second smallest until the second smallest is paid off. Once the second smallest is paid off, take all the monthly payments that you were making from the first and the second, put it towards the third. And that's how you will continue. So that's why it's a snowball effect. It's like when a snowball is rolling under downhill, right? It just starts to get momentum. So that's one of the things. The other thing that I do recommend is if you are heavily in debt and you're like, I don't know where to start, this is where the extra stream of income will come in. Find a service that you offer. If you know how to bake, you have a talent for baking, start baking biscuits, start baking things. I've worked with my family members on this and it works. Do you have a talent for sewing? Offer to sew. Don't do things that will require like lots of time and effort, right? So if you know how to sew, offer a service to sew things for 50 Rand. Like say, when your dress is torn, I will sew it. Don't do dresses because those take time and people will argue with you around pricing. So you don't want to dysregulate your nervous system.
Yeah.
So do small things, high volume. Sell, sell, sell. And every bit of money that you make that's extra, put it towards the debt. It is completely a game changer.
Yeah.
This is how I paid off $60,000 in debt in 3.5 years, earning South African rands. And my debt was denominated in rands, dollars, and pounds.
Mm.
So I had to deal with the currency fluctuations as well with my debt.
Yeah. Vangile, what's one specific belief or thought that might be sabotaging someone's wealth, even if they're earning money?
Oh, man. I don't think there's actually one.
Oh, even worse.
And the reason for that is I was telling a friend a few days ago that I'm so annoyed by how people simplify money trauma. And all I heard when I was starting out on my money journey, right, on my personal finance journey, was people saying, oh, look at the beliefs that you're taught from childhood where your parents say money don't grow on tree, it doesn't grow on trees, or you have to work hard for money. Those are the core beliefs. And I'm like, no, because some of your deepest beliefs actually have nothing to do with money, but they are impacting your financial goals. They're impacting your ability to make money. Mm. So what I have learned in my work and the work that I do with clients is some of the deepest, deepest beliefs that we that are blocking us financially have absolutely got nothing to do with money directly.
Mm.
However, they are beliefs that have shaped our view of ourselves and have impacted our self-confidence and our self-esteem, which has made it hard for us to then make money or save money or invest money because of how we view ourselves. So I would say really look at beliefs around self-perception as well. Look at family stories that you've held within your family, right? And then look at your money story as well. But in my experience, it is often never about the money, even when it is about the money.
Yeah. You're so right. I really believe that is true, because I'm thinking of instances and stories I've heard where at the root of it, at the heart of it, it really wasn't about the money. It was about something else. Either that happened when they were younger, or that happened recently that completely traumatized or changed their views of themselves. And now it's affecting how they view money, and it's changed their money story altogether.
Yeah.
Do you think there are some modern wealth traps, like things that look like opportunities but are actually slowing us down when it comes to building wealth?
Oh, yeah. There is one thing I will say. There's a hill I'm willing to die on. I was telling my husband about it last night. Is this obsession with multiple streams of income that people have?
How?
That is like side hustles.
Okay.
Side hustles are the death of many people. Like you find someone that has 7 different ways of making money, and none of the ways are actually working because you have spread yourself thin. You need a separate accountant for your 7 streams of income. You only have so many hours in a day. So you hold a job, but you have 5 or 3 other streams of income. You come home and you only have 3 hours left after dealing with the kids, and you spread yourself thin trying to make money from all 3 streams of income. You never focus on one thing and never grow it and expand it. It is a trap. It is a trap, especially in today's world where there are so many opportunities where someone will tell you, oh, the path is through starting a service-based business. Another will tell you, oh, but Tommy, you have a baking gift.
Yeah.
Oh, Tommy, but there's, you also know how to sell. So do have a life.
Eesh.
Oh, no. Eesh. You know, so suddenly you're doing so many things, but there is nothing that's really sticking. So I feel like that is the biggest trap. Have one strategy. Work the strategy and it will work. You know, I remember being in business school and one of our lecturers saying during my MBA program, she would say things like, It's better to have a mediocre strategy that you execute every day than to have an excellent strategy that you never, ever execute. Like success, she was saying, if you look at all the most successful companies in the world, it's not about the strategy. It's that they had some strategy, even if it's mediocre, but they executed that strategy like their lives depended on it. And that's for us. So choose a strategy with one or two things. If you have a job, do one side hustle and choose that. Have a strategy and work that strategy. It's better to do that than to have an excellent strategy that you never implement because you have seven side hustles. And when people tell you about streams of income, you're working after every stream of income.
And all these streams require different strategies, because if you're dropshipping and network marketing and you're a consultant,
And people love that. That's the latest thing, right? You're a slash this, a slash that. Yeah. You're multi-talented, hyper-talented. Listen, we all have so many things that we're talented at.
True.
But choose a thing. Choose a thing. It doesn't matter if it's a mediocre strategy. Just choose the thing and work with that one thing.
Now, I think the fear around that is, what if I focus on this thing for so long and it doesn't work? When do I know when to quit? And what if that other one would have taken had I focused?
But you won't know that, right? It's easier to give your all for a year and say, you know what, or 2 years.
Correct.
And give your all and say, this isn't working.
Correct.
And then change gears and fail fast. And then also figure out, okay, why am I failing? Where's the disconnect here? Okay, this is the support that I need, because this seems to be working here, but the disconnect is somewhere else. It's not working over here. So I need support here.
Yeah.
Because you won't be failing at everything.
That's true.
Maybe in the process you'll find out, you know what? My systems build as I'm building the side hustle. My systems are on lock. My weakness is marketing. So maybe when you do decide to fail fast and shut down and close up shop, you go, I'm going to consult on helping people have rock solid systems in their businesses because that's something I'm good at. You will learn something in the process.
That's so true. You know, I was going to ask you next how creatives and freelancers or entrepreneurs whose income is obviously inconsistent can still build long-term wealth. And what you just said now, I think, is the answer, right? And I was having a conversation with someone earlier that the thing that people, and especially creatives, and freelancers and entrepreneurs don't do is set up systems. They stay entrepreneurs and they never become organizations, however little. And what a system allows you to do, it allows you to see exactly where the backlog is, what isn't working, because you might find your idea is great and maybe the execution is even brilliant, but somewhere in the system there's a disconnect. There's something that isn't quite translating. And if you can pinpoint that and fix it, the entire system works. So, I think that would be the answer. Maybe you've got something else, but really for those whose income is inconsistent, at least you know why there's inconsistency. And if you have a system, then you can repeat processes. Then it can be sustainable, but without that system, it's just never going to work.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people just kind of wing it, right? Because you're going from pillar to post. It's just, I need to do whatever it takes to make money.
Yeah.
And you never get, and when you're in that mode, you never ever get to sit down and look and say, where is it? Okay, so now I'm marketing this. So many people have signed up for this, or so many people have clicked on this and have inquired about it, but I've only had X amount of people buy. That's lower than industry average. Where am I failing? So that when you do go ask for help, you're able to say, this is exactly where my problem is. But again, another hill I'm willing to die on, right, is that a lot of people don't get there, not because they don't know systems. We can't even talk systems because they are so dysregulated. So what I do with clients is to say, I don't even get to that point for months on end, because it doesn't matter what I say. If you are panicked and stressed and you are being run by your four-year-old, adult you won't hear me when I talk about systems. So the first thing will always be, how do you work on your nervous system so that you can be regulated enough to then look at those numbers? And that may take 6 months. It may even take 12 months with clients. But when you get there, it is so worth it. It's better than spinning your wheels for 4 years and then like coming back and being like, nothing has ever worked. I suck at entrepreneurship. I suck at investing. I suck at everything. Rather, and most people are so dysregulated, they're not willing to take that chance because they're so scared that I won't have money to eat. This needs to work. It needs to work right now. They don't even give themselves those 6 months to 12 months to get to regulation so that the next 3 years are about thriving instead of really wallowing and drowning for another 4 years because you never got the foundation right.
I remember when I was that person telling my coach, I only have a month to survive. If this thing doesn't work in a month, and she was just like, girl, get out of here. Just do the work. Do the work and stop playing. You know, man, what we've uncovered tonight is really money mastery, right? Unlearning survival, relearning stewardship, and building structures that hold, structures that grow, and structures that can transfer wealth across time. And I really just want to say, for anybody who's listening, or anyone who is truly listening, we will know that wealth is not a mystery. It's really a method. And it's a method that we haven't learned. But now that we are getting all this information and we're understanding all these things, we've got no excuse but to actually put them in place. You spoke about having a perfect system, but never, or a perfect information, but never doing anything with that strategy. What is the point? Then you might as well just toss it in the trash, because you're wasting your time, you're wasting your potential because of everything that you do know, but aren't just using. I really think when we stop waiting for inheritance and start building it, that will change the game for us. And so, Vanila, thank you so much for sharing the truths that most only whisper about. And I don't even think some are whispering about it. They're having it in their homes because it's been a tradition. And I'm talking about our white counterparts, right? For us, it's such a weird conversation. And maybe that is why we get fidgety. Maybe that is why we start sweating and we start stuttering, because what are you talking about? And I think it's not even that you are bad with money. It's that maybe I should know this, but I don't. What does that say about me? Oh my goodness. It becomes such a problem. And I think you've handed us the keys in this conversation without the gatekeeping. You've reminded us that it's not too late to change the story. And it's also not too early to start writing a better one, especially with your little ones, especially with the ones that are going to be left behind when you leave, or who can actually, because of time, changing so much and us learning so many things over time, they can even magnify or grow the little seeds that you plant in their minds and their hearts today. So thank you so much for having this conversation with us, Vanile.
Oh, it's such a pleasure for me. Have Cutting a fantastic shots. Evening, Zerba, and thank you to everyone who tuned in.
Somebody said I always ask for parting shots from my guest, and I just did it again, so I might as well do it fully and with my chest. Do you have any parting shots?
No, really. Just to say, remember, it's never about the money, even when it is about the money.
Yeah.
That's my favorite thing to tell people.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this chat. You are always a delight.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye. Bye. My parting shot is, whether you're the first in your family to try or the first to triumph tonight, you've been equipped to be able to be the one who shifts the tide. I don't care what situation you're in. In fact, I don't like it when people say, I don't care. It doesn't matter what situation you're in. It doesn't matter how much debt you're in, how much money you've lost, how many mistakes you've made, how many times you've fallen. It really does not matter. With this information, with this new mindset, with the ability to actually move yourself forward. Please be the one that shifts the tide for your nervous system, for that four-year-old Vangile kept talking about, but also for your family, because we were talking generational wealth. I am Nompumelelo Lombonane, and I hope you've just made sense of your business. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.